brief of the 2023 Oregon legislative session. More information about the Urban League of Portland can be found online at ulpdx.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
Tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Many people ask me what my show, Radio Lost and Found, is about, and I tell them it's about 1 hour 58 minutes. Radio Lost and Found is a 2-hour mediascape of found sounds, forgotten records, outre recordings, and more, coming to you every second and fourth Thursday from 10 to midnight. Right here on KBOO.
Does your employer have a matching gifts program? Many companies offer dollar-for-dollar matching charitable contributions for donations you make to KBOO. The impact of your gift may be doubled or possibly tripled. Participating companies also match gifts made by retirees and/or spouses. Matching gifts are a great way for you to maximize your membership dollars. Check with your company's human resources or accounting departments to find out if your employer matches charitable contributions, then request a matching gift form. For more information on companies making matching gifts, go to kboo.fm/employer matching. There's something missing and I'm lit and I got something to say.
Good evening, you're listening to Transpositive here on KBOO Community Radio. My name is Emma and I use she and her pronouns.
My name is Nicolette and I use they, them, AM, and fey, fair pronouns.
My name is Gigi and I use she, her pronouns.
My name is Sheila and I use she and her pronouns.
Great, so before we get started, why don't we do a quick go around and we can chat with everyone and just tell us how things are going with your life. Would you like to start, Nicolette?
Yeah, I guess I can start. I'm not having the best week right now because I just broke up with one of my partners a few days ago and I'm dealing with a lot of stress in my personal life. But, you know, on top of that, there's some very depressing things going on in the news right now, which we'll be talking about pretty soon. So I'm not in the best mood, but you know what? I'm going to stick with it and hope we'll have a great show.
And how are you doing, Gigi?
Well, you know, first of all, I'm sorry again to Nicolette for going with, you know, with what's going on in your life. And I definitely empathize with you. I've had kind of a rough week myself, just some health stuff, but I'll be okay. I'm strong, you know. Otherwise than that, I've been kind of in an introspective kind of plane of thought, just thinking about, you know, my mom, thinking about, You know, I'm just thinking about, you know, things I'm going to get into further discussion later tonight, you know, regarding, you know, the kind of work that my mom and people did as activists in the 60s and 70s. So I just been kind of that kind of played, that state of mind, just thinking about things a lot. But I'm good otherwise.
And what's going on with you, Sheila?
How things are going for me right now, I'm bringing out a new edition of my book on transsexualism. Its title is Transsexualism and Its Discontents. And it is up on Amazon right now. And I think it'll be useful to people to look at, because I try to deal with as completely as I can, not only with my personal experience, but with topical essays on what we go through as a community.
Well, thanks everyone for checking in. I guess I'll check in now too. For me, you know, I mean, my life's going pretty good. I mean, this heat has really been kind of overwhelming. And I mean, I'm really concerned about people who are having to live out in the streets right now and who are having to endure this heat, because it's so overwhelming. And you know, I have to admit, I really have a lot of fear about the future of our planet. I'm just consumed with worry about, right now I'm really concerned about the oceans and about life in the ocean and life on Earth. And I just don't see how we're going to survive this. I mean, it feels like it's beyond the point of just that we need to change. I mean, we're kind of starting to get into survival mode, which it's hard for me to like really kind of see it clearly, because it's like, as a trans person, I feel like we're always in survival mode all the time. And it's like this climate catastrophe is just like, it's an overlaying level of anxiety over all the anxiety I already have to deal with from day to day. But in other ways, I'm having a really fun summer. To cool down, I've been going down to the river, and I've been swimming down in the river, and that's been a really nice way to cool down. And we've been really busy at KBOO. I don't talk a lot about KBOO on this show, but I'm the president of KBOO this year, and we're just about to go into the round of budget conversations on the board for 23-24, and I'm pretty excited. I mean, KBOO is really doing great. We have a new station manager, and I really loved the old station manager too. He was great, and all the station managers before that. Now we have another station manager, and he's doing a great job. And the staff are all doing wonderful. I mean, it's amazing what happened this summer. The staff did like 3 or 4 remotes, and it was just really amazing. But still, I'm concerned about the future of KBOO, because costs have really gone up. The budget of KBOO is about $1.16 million this year, and that's a lot for our little community radio station. We've never raised that much money before, but that's what our budget is this year. So we're having to do a lot of creative thinking about our budget and trying to figure out what to do about it. So that's taking a lot of my time. Honestly, KBOO just takes a lot of my energy. And I'm just so appreciative of the board. I'm really appreciative of all the people who serve on the board. Anna Hershaw, Jill Blanchard, Joyce, and just everybody on the board is just doing an amazing job. So I just really appreciate all of our board members, Carmen and Charles. Hope Charles gets better soon. And anyways, I could just go on and talk about KBOO, but we're actually here tonight because we're here to talk about transgender rights and transgender issues. So why don't you tell us what the topic is for tonight, Nicolette?
Yeah, basically we're going to be talking about the continued attacks on gender-affirming healthcare. The new House Republicans' fiscal 2024 spending bill covering the federal health department would bar taxpayer funding of hormone therapies and gender-affirming surgeries. Under this policy, Medicare and TRICARE could not cover gender-affirming care, and states choosing to cover these services through Medicaid could not use federal funds to do so. This bill is moving through Congress and has met very little pushback from Democrats. The sweeping defense policy bill that the House passed on Friday also prohibits TRICARE from paying for gender-affirming services. And the GOP has also advanced legislation to keep children's hospitals that offer gender-affirming care to minors from receiving federal funds to train pediatric residents. Some states have enacted their own bans on gender-affirming care, with 7 expressly banning Medicaid coverage for gender-affirming services. So do we want to talk about that before we move on?
So I'd like to talk about this this article that you've mentioned, Nicolette, because I just want to kind of point people to where it's at, where it's located, and some of the really key things it's bringing up. So the article is called, the article is titled, "National Anti-Trans Bans Loom. Will Democrats Surrender Trans Rights?" And it's published by a blogger named Erin Reed, who has a blog called Erin in the Morning. And it's, I think it's right now, it's probably the best source of news and information about what's going on nationally around transgender rights. I mean, it's written by somebody who has enormous sympathy for issues around transgender legislation. I don't know if the author themselves is transgender or not, but everything that they report on is transgender, and it is some of the best in independent journalism. Again, it's called Erin in the Morning. That's E-R-I-N in the morning.com. And basically in this article, she's saying that Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene put forth a string of amendments, basically that would provide a complete ban on funding for almost anything having to do with transgender healthcare. And the funding could affect children's hospitals. It definitely would affect veterans. It's basically just, it's a really big mess. And it's an amendment to House Resolution 4368 offered by, again, Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia. She's the Trump cheerleader who's been cheering on Trump for years now and, you know, trying to make a name for herself by stomping on the backs of transgender people in the same way that Trump has, in the same way that especially DeSantis has. So this particular piece of legislation probably isn't going to go anywhere, but it's kind of a test. And that's kind of what Erin's getting at towards the end of the article. Erin's really getting at this. Basically what Erin is wondering is how far the Democrats are going to let this go. And so one of the things that Erin does is Erin does some really great research. I mean, Erin is definitely a top-notch journalist. And Erin does some great research. And what Erin has found out is that about 60% of all voters across the board, this is, Erin didn't do this poll. This is a poll from the Data for Progress, an organization called Data for Progress, and they sampled 1,254 likely voters between July 19th and the 20th, and they basically asked them the following statement. Do you agree or disagree that anti-LGBTQ measures should not be included in bills focused on military spending? So basically she's asking, do you think that what Marjorie Taylor Greene did by including anti-LGBTQ bills into a military spending bill Is that something that you support or you oppose? And 60% of all voters said that they do not think that that is a good idea. They do not support that. So, of Democrats, it's 67%. But even of Republicans, it was 51%. So it was over a majority. Now, one thing I do want to bring up here is that this is a really complicated issue. It's just like when we've had shows before about trans folks in the military. I mean, every organization in our society should totally be open to transgender people. But at the same time, trying to make a justice argument on the basis of the military is a really tough move. I mean, I understand the military played a big role in desegregation in following World War II, or at least that's the myth I've heard. I don't know how much truth there is in it, or if desegregation was just something that was it was a force that was really just built on the organizing of people of color in the South. I mean, I'm not sure that the military really, but that's what I was taught in school, so I don't want to ignore that. But, you know, regardless, I just don't think that an organization that's dedicated to mass murder is really the best organization for making an argument about the advocacy of trans rights, or as an institution that you're supposed to attach an argument about progress around trans rights, because it's just super complicated. I mean, the military is basically used to, you know, suppress, to murder, to assassinate, to control, you know, the global South, to control, you know, places that we want to control in the name of, you know, our idea of what U.S. empire is. And so it's hard for me to really say, oh, it's okay to then pull data from, you know, a very well-intentioned poll that's about, you know, trans rights. But at the same time, I understand transgender people serve in the military. So there's, that's that. Anyways, so back to the article here. Basically, what Aaron Reed is concerned about and writes about quite a bit here is there's a real concern that the Democrats are going to cave on trans rights at some point in the next year or two. There's been so much pressure, and there's been so much pushback in terms of progress around trans rights. And there's just a real concern right now that if, you know, if there's a tight race or if there is insufficient leadership within the Democratic caucus, that the Democrats might cave on trans rights. And there's this constant barrage of bills introduced by the right wing, by people like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Ron DeSantis. And it's just this slow motion, like, you know, just complete abnegation of rights for trans and non-binary people. And we're just kind of watching it happen in front of us. So that's basically my take on what this article is about. What do you think, Nicolette?
Do you mind if I chime in here?
Please.
Because I've been listening and just been taking deep breaths every time I hear that woman speak. I have never liked her. I didn't like her when she ran the first time in 2020 as she jumped on Trump's boat. I don't like her now. I don't like her politics. And I've got to wonder why. What is it about the trans community, the transgender community, that frightens these far-right, bigoted people in Congress, in state houses, across the country, in red states? What is it that they fear about us so much that they want to eliminate our health care? What does it do for you? What do you get out of it? The fact that you're an unhappy person with a miserable life and you've got to make everybody else unhappy. So if you take your power and use it, then, you know, you feel like you achieve it and you just leave a lot of people devastated. But I think we have got to remind the Democrats who are currently in power in the state level and the federal level that the LGBTQ community is a big part of the voting block of the Democrats. And to leave us behind the road just to cover your butts for next year's elections, I don't think shows much integrity about these national so-called Democratic leaders. So I'm sorry if I sound upset, but I'm trying to every time I see Marjorie Taylor Greene or I see Lauren Boebert or I see Kevin McCarthy, my blood pressure boils and I've got to step back and relax a while. But we have really got to get on the Democratic leaders on the state and national level and remind them how much of a big voting block the LGBTQ community is. And to do this is could jeopardize their vote. You know, I'm not going to vote Republican, but I'm certainly not going to vote for these so-called leaders of the party.
Well, in answer to Gigi's question, why are they doing this? What I've noticed in listening to the rhetoric is certain things keep coming up again and again and again. The first seems to be athletics, and the idea there seems to be that women's sports are being invaded by people who have an innate biological advantage, and because of that, they feel that it's an unfair thing to women's athletics, forgetting, of course, the tiny number of transgender people who are actually involved at a level of competition where that's even going to matter. So that, but it brings in, of course, the famous bathroom issue and who will be allowed in what restrooms or changing spaces. So that's one thing that comes up. The other is characterizing the surgery as mutilation, which means that it implies that these doctors are basically butchers rather than skilled surgeons, which is as insulting to them as medical professionals as it is to us. The next is parental rights and the parental need to know. And there is where they come up with the idea that this is an ideology and that somehow transgender people are asking everyday people who do not have our particular issue to somehow question their gender. And I've never, ever heard any transgender person ever say that most people are transsexual. That's never been the case. It's always been a clinical issue involving a tiny minority of people for whom it's a very profound issue. But the way they have framed it is that to make transgender surgery possible causes everyday other people who have no connection to the transgender community to question their own gender, which seems to imply that gender is more fluid than any transgender person has ever said it is. The next thing that they come up with is the idea that somehow or other this is a fundamental division of the human species, and that to question it is to interfere with God's will for all of humankind. So this is where it has a religious overlap, and it also has an idea that we have to get back to some sort of definitions of that everyone will accept. And so they say, if we can go after the transgender people first, we can go after the gay people tomorrow, and then we can make sure that every distinction that has ever existed, whether it's racial, also be radical. In other words, their real problem is they feel that essentialist discourses no longer exist and that everything has become political. And because of that, they feel that somehow that's almost causing language to dissolve. There's a lot of nomenclature battles between show that undermines the English language. And so what's happened is our tiny community has suddenly become the free fire zone of every cultural battle that actually is raging around us and has really very little to do with us. It has everything to do with social anxiety. So that's something I'd like to concentrate on today, is to say, what's causing this degree of social anxiety? Because that's where fascist movements always come from. They emerge out of social anxiety.
You know, I'm sorry, I hope you don't mind me chiming in here. You know, you're right. Statewide, here in Oregon, especially in Oregon, we're very protected. And you know what? Because I want to find a positive in this right now with the healthcare, and at least in this state, something I have been fighting for 8 years, finally got passed. I mean, we had to deal with the Republicans kind of walking out, you know, even though they know now with, you know, with the new amendments that they can face real trouble, you know, if they do that. But we finally got the care. We finally got the state health insurance, the health insurance system in general in Oregon, to cover new procedures in terms of what we're already receiving with gender reassignment surgery, hormones, you know, top surgery. But now they're covering facial feminization surgery. They're covering vocal therapy. They're covering hair removal, things that would have been considered cosmetic when this thing first started. It's finally been changed into law, and now it is part of the healthcare system. And I have been waiting the last 8 years for that, because when how I got it was dumb luck. It was just pure luck. I didn't do anything different. I just happened to have been, I just requested it when it first happened. When I requested getting facial surgery 8 years ago, I didn't know it wasn't covered. I just assumed it was covered with everything else, because the law was pretty vague, you know. And the fact that I was able to beat the system is what I did. It's why I fought for 8 years. And I even asked Governor Kotek at a town hall meeting before she was governor. This was when she was, I think she had just become a Speaker of the House, and I brought, you know, are you guys going to change the healthcare system so that, you know, traditionally considered cosmetic surgeries will now be, or cosmetic treatments will now be considered, you know, mandatory with trans healthcare. And to see that it is now, I feel like I can take a deep breath, because I felt guilty. I felt terrible for having the surgery, because, like, you know, I'm seeing my friends here at least rejuvenated, trying to get their surgeries and being denied. So now that this has been passed, I feel like I can take a break. I can take a deep breath. And it's like, I definitely like what you said in that article, especially with the fact that the voters throughout the country, I think, are more liberal and progressive than Republicans like to think. And they're holding on to any kind of, the party is really in a state of, I'm 44 years old and I've been following politics for 30 years. I have never seen the Republican Party in this kind of disarray, where they don't know what their identity is and they're not sure if they like the one that they have. So they've got a problem. They've got to latch on to anything that they think might get them votes. And even if they're not able to see that a good chunk of the country doesn't support them, outside of maybe, you know, the far right voters. So, you know, that I want to thank you for, I'm hoping I read onto that correctly, but I feel like the party, you know, is so disarrayed right now. They're trying to grab anything they think might rejuvenate their base, because they don't have much of an identity anymore.
Well, one of the things is that here's where I think we're at as a country. I believe that everybody knows that we're here now. But there's no idea that our community is invisible anymore. So, and once you're really invisible and recognized, it's almost impossible to disappear again, even if people want us to disappear. So the question is, trying to get our heads around, what if we imagine the world that they're trying to create for us? What if we imagine trans people in various stages of transition are suddenly it's being forced to go into bathrooms that they've left behind a long time ago and do not seem to match anymore. What kind of chaos is that going to create? What is it going to be if people go to school looking like one gender, but all the pronouns coming out of the teacher's mouth are saying you have to go back to the gender where you were? Isn't that going to be more disruptive and confusing to a classroom? And won't there be laughter on that? Not so much laughing at the trans person, but laughing at the teacher as if they are clueless because they are being forced by the administration to not use appropriate pronouns. So the world that they're trying to create is a dream world in which they can target a group of people and just say, you need to disappear. And this is where Nicolette's wonderful presentation on genocide comes in. When you want people to disappear, what it says is there's always a threat of violence behind that. And society that tolerates violence, localized violence to any group of people, is never going to be a pleasant society to live in. So when these laws finally go into effect in some of these places, they're going to cause a certain amount of social chaos. And there's going to be records of that. People have cell phones. They're going to be videotaping this kind of stuff. And they're going to be videotaping the violence, like the situation that happened in New York, where someone is just dancing at a gas station and ends up being knifed. This has been on the national news phase now. And, you know, everybody's been aware. Pose was on Netflix for a while, that wonderful series Pose, and it's as though everyone's aware that we're here, and so they're not going to like seeing us killed or knifed at places or beaten up or insulted. That's going to look bad, and when that happens, that's actually how social consciousness evolves over time. People don't like the visuals of people being treated badly. And we are being treated badly. But we're actually kind of the canaries of the coal mine, because there's a lot of bad stuff coming down right now. A lot of social stress. In fact, just this week, a major rating agency rated American debt as two A's rather than triple A's. And what that means is that we're not a good investment as a country. And one of the reasons they said is because of political turmoil. Well, that's the kind of thing we associate with third world countries, not with America. So anyway, even though we feel like it's all landing at our doorstep, it's really affecting the whole country. And it's we're not alone this time. There's going to be people that will notice this.
We are still suffering from this sort of lack of empathy in our society, where people think, well, if this doesn't affect me, then I don't care. And at the same time, you know, we've got people largely on the Republican side that are just like, if anyone is different from me, then I automatically don't like them and I want them to not exist anymore. And I think that's why, you know, we're seeing so much anti-trans legislation from the right and not quite enough pushback from the left to try and prevent it, because the reality is trans people are a minority. And yes, you know, you said that the majority of voters were saying that this legislation doesn't belong in this bill, but at the same time, we've also got an awful lot of even people who call themselves Democrats, call themselves leftists, who, because they're not trans and they don't know anyone who's trans, they just don't care enough about the issue to actually fight and advocate for our rights. And maybe I'm just on a bit of a pessimistic ramble, but that's part of my thoughts of it. But when I get into the next article I want to talk about, I think I'm going to circle back to this. So, in other news, A study was published just yesterday, August 9th, in the journal JAMA Surgery, showing that trans and non-binary people who had gender-affirming mastectomy, sometimes called top surgery, had extremely low rates of regretting the decision and extremely high levels of satisfaction with their decision to have the procedure. The results were overwhelmingly positive compared to other medical and non-medical decisions. Researchers surveyed 235 people who had gender-affirming mastectomy at the University of Michigan last year, and the participants were between 2 and 24 years past their surgeries. The participants' median satisfaction with the decision scale was 5 on a 5-point scale, meaning the highest possible level of satisfaction. The median decision regret scale score was 0 on a 100-point scale, meaning not a single patient regretted their choice to have the surgery. None of the participants underwent a reversal procedure, and a quarter of the participants underwent additional gender-affirming procedures after their mastectomy. This study builds on earlier work that found deep satisfaction among people who had some sort of surgical procedure as part of gender-affirming care. A review of multiple studies published in 2021 found that among patients who received transmasculine and transfeminine procedures, only 1% regretted it. Meanwhile, studies show that the average rate of regret for other types of surgical procedures is 14.4%, meaning that gender-affirming surgeries have a much higher rate of decision satisfaction than other types of surgeries. And I just think this ties into this wave of bans on gender-affirming care we've been discussing, because so many transphobes are convinced that trans people will regret transitioning, when in reality, studies show that the rate of satisfaction with transition is extremely high and the rate of regret is extremely low. But they're not looking to ban these other surgeries where people are more likely to regret it. It's about taking away trans rights. It's not about, you know, preventing people from making decisions they'll regret.
I was going to, this is Gigi, I was going to state that, you know, I think having the surgeries I did, going on hormones, going on therapy was probably the best thing I ever did. And at this point now, 10 years into the transition, I don't even think about what I've had surgery on. It's like, that's just my body. It's how it's always should have been. It's how it's always should have been. And there are no regrets, because I loved it. I love how my body looks now. There are surgeries I've had that are non-trans related that I have regrets about, you know, certain aspects of it. But never did I ever have any regrets towards my surgery. So when I see these videos, or I see people trying to pull these ads saying, oh, you know, you're going to regret transitioning, or you're going to regret doing a surgery, it's like, I don't know who you're paying me. I don't know too many people who are like that. So I think, you know, for them, it's gross to film these advertisements talking about having regrets towards transition, when I don't know anybody who's regretted going through the process, because it makes us feel complete. I sure know I feel complete.
I have a question right now to have all of us consider. The question is, when do you succeed as a group of people? When you can merge flawlessly so that they don't know you're there? Or have you really arrived when you can be out and proud and visibly and affirmatively trans without necessarily blending? In fact, in the old days, the idea was, if I can blend, my life will be easier because people won't clock me. They will not be able to harm me. But increasingly, I'm finding myself wanting to go back to the way it was in the early, early trans days that I was coming up in, which was that we were out as trans, and it was really clear that we demanded to be recognized as trans. So even those of us that could blend, the idea was, if we blend, we disappear. And when we disappear, we can't be sure that we really have our rights, because because what if we didn't? So lately I'm very much aligned with what I think of as transgender solidarity, which means that whether you're a beauty pageant person or whether or not you're just an everyday looking person or whether you're not someone that they can still tell that you're trans, it shouldn't really matter. But unfortunately, it kind of does. And so they actually use us and divide us according to our own ability to meet their idea of what a gender is. And I think the only way we're ever going to have gender equity in America is when we reach the point where we say we just judge people anywhere they come at us, and we don't try to fit them into a pre-existing template and then ask how successful they are at meeting that template.
Well, I'm really glad you mentioned that, Sheila. I mean, I just think it's so interesting because the idea of passing is just such a challenging idea in the transgender community. I have a friend, I've talked about her before on the show. I'm the host of a group on Facebook called Trans Sex Talk. And it's a place for like a frank and open conversation from a sex positive perspective about sexuality from a transgender for the transgender community. And I have this friend on there, and she's a sex worker, she's a transgender sex worker, and she's always saying that, like, I mean, she's really proud of herself, and she says, I look exactly like how a trans woman is supposed to look, and I'm proud of myself. And what she means is that, like, she, you know, there's a whole generation of people like us who we didn't start on hormone blockers when we were 13 or 11. And, you know, a lot of us didn't even transition until maybe we were in our 20s or 30s. You know, a lot of people don't transition until they're in their 40s or 50s. And it's like our lives are always celebrated. I mean, our lives are celebrated as like, oh, look at how much courage it took them to transition. But we're never really held up as being beautiful or attractive or desirable. And, you know, I feel like, I mean, the work that people like Sylvia Rivera did and all of the activists, all of the transgender activists who were engaged in the Stonewall riots was about opening up a space in society where we can be seen and where we can be seen as we are. You know, I mean, transgender people are very beautiful. And I feel like, you know, we have to move ourselves. It's not enough to just like say, oh, if you start at a certain age, a transgender body can look almost exactly like a cisgender body. It's not enough to just say that. I mean, that should definitely be something that people should be able to do. And I think we all understand the benefits of it. But we also have to go the other way. Just like we're doing with so many other things in our society, we have to learn how to unsee what we've been conditioned, and we have to learn how to see again, how to see what's really in front of us. Because just like with you know, the body positivity movement, like a lot of what we need to do is we need to decolonize our minds, because our minds have been colonized by advertising. I mean, ever since we were as young as we possibly could be, anyone who grew up in America has basically been mass bombarded with images about how your body is supposed to be. And those images don't include acceptance of anything that is less than, you know, looking like a model. So there's a lot of shaming that goes on around different kinds of bodies. And transgender people kind of fit into that narrative. And it's this whole oppressive system that's been created by capitalism. And it's created in order to enslave us into, you know, mass consumption. I mean, we're supposed to basically fit our brains into the world that advertisers want us to accept. And to basically, the only reason that they do it is to enrich themselves. So that's the only reason that, you know, we're put under so much pressure to conform. And I feel like what you were talking about there, Sheila, and the kind of stuff that Sylvia Rivera like did so much work around was around kind of decolonizing our minds and getting us to see each other and see the beauty in every person and see the beauty in transgender people, you know, to see how beautiful and attractive transgender people really are.
Emma, do you mind if I chime in here? Because this is going, the way the conversation is going right now with mentioning Sylvia Rivera, mentioning the work we did in the past to get to where we even are now. You know, when I was watching this program about the social movements of the late of the 60s, and I'm talking about civil rights, feminism, environmentalism, gay rights, you know, trans rights with Sylvia Rivera and Marsha P. Johnson. You know, the one thing I noticed watching this video was when they fought, they were united. They were united and they supported each other. And they, you know, if one was down, the others came to pick them up and they fought together. And because they fought together, they made some pretty big changes, because I saw stuff in the early 60s on these segments, the conversations, the things that people were just saying about minorities, it was just gross. It was terrible. It was the way they talked about women, the way they talked about people of color, the way they talked about the LGBT community. And then, you know, 9 years later down the road, because of unity, because of fight, because of anger, because of, hey, we cannot live like this anymore and we've got to be open. You know, you saw a lot of social changes. And I look at my mother, and I transitioned when I was in my 30s, you know, and I, you know, as I'm 44 now, and I look at my body and it's like, you know, it's not a supermodel body, but you know what? I love it. I love it because I worked and I fought, and I appreciate the people who worked and fought to allow me to have the ability to change my body and correct it the way it should have been. You know, and, you know, I look at them and I look at my body now and I can appreciate that. I appreciate what they gave me. And so I think the best way right now for the community to fight during these crises is to have the same kind of unity and fight that they had back in the 60s. And so I love that the conversation is going towards that. And I hopefully as I age, you know, I will continue on the same kind of cause that my mother raised me to believe in, because these were the same things I was raised to believe in. And so I've been, you know, that's the conversation I wanted to share, was looking back at our pioneers, Sylvia Rivera, Marsha P. Johnson, you know, countless people who got us here. And I look at my mother and I think the best way to honor my mother and the best way to honor them is to continue to fight the way they did in these times. The topics might have changed a little bit, but the passion never will, as long as we're together. And I hope I didn't ramble on there. I wanted to share that last bit of thought about how they fought the wars and how we can take their identity, how we can take what they fought, how they fought, and maybe apply it to what we're doing now.
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. I remember what it was like in my 20s, and I remember what it was like in my 30s. And I used to kind of like the edginess. I liked the idea that I was belonging to a group of people that were walking along the edge of saying to straight society and saying to kind of what I think of as, you know, everything that goes along with Ozzie and Harriet, 50s, straight-laced. I saw so much oppression, even for the people that could buy into that, that to stand outside of that and to be able to, in a sense, know that it bothered them was actually a kind of a good feeling, because it felt like freedom. And that's what Stonewall was all about. That's what that edginess meant. That's what you see in New Orleans series. You see what it's like to be not part of mainstream culture. And I think what this pushback that we're getting lately is the idea is, you'll never be one of us, so stop trying. We don't even want to use your pronouns. That's how far we want to carry this thing. You're going to either shape up and adapt to where we want you to be, or forget it. We're not going to even acknowledge you. You are just a non-person. I don't think they realize what it is to say that to any other human being, and how unchristian that is, how evil that is. And so when they do that, it takes the edgy people. The edgy people that keep the society functioning, because without it, we'd all be zombies. We'd be walking around like sleepwalkers, because we'd just be following all the cues. And the cues would seem to be to say, don't mess it up. Understand that we're all walking in lockstep here, and if you walk in lockstep with us, we will honor you. But what is it to them to walk in lockstep? I used to feel I would sit in a restaurant, and people would come up and tell me their whole life story, and I was like, am I like their confessor? I mean, like, why are they don't know me, but they trusted me. And the reason that they trusted me was because they knew that I was willing to be so real that I was willing to step outside of the social norms, and that liberated them to tell me their stories. And I was always so impressed by that. I said, well, maybe that's my social function, basically be there to remind people of what freedom looks like.
I would just say, you know, face the struggles, look at the struggles and the hardships, but also appreciate and value the victories that we get. And we won a pretty big victory this year with reproductive health care and trans health care in Oregon. So that's, I really take advantage of that win, even against the Marjorie Greens of this world.
Would anybody else like to offer any closing thoughts?
I have one other one. Let's assume for a second that our function in a wider anthropology is to be different. Because if we look around us really, really carefully, we will notice that the human race is massively diverse. It's unbelievable how many varieties of things there are. And it's very interesting that in spite of the fact that we think that we're so evolved, the fact is that the basic societies that exist in indigenous people all around the world is that they are tribal. They are involved in ritual. They are involved in expressiveness and in artistry. So when I see drag queens or I see trans people, what I see is people that are living out an artistic sense of who they are. And that's actually what I mean by freedom. It means daringness to be able to even be vulnerable. The mere fact that we can be hurt as badly as we are shows our humanity. I wouldn't want to be someone who is so impregnable that nobody could ever hurt me. If you can't hurt me, you don't even know me. Because I know my own vulnerabilities, and I know those of our people. And so I think that's what will always draw people to us, because they'll say, my God, I couldn't do what you're doing. And I used to say, I'm not a hero. I'm just doing what I have to do. But it was interesting that they perceived it as heroic just to exist. And maybe that's something we need to remind people of, what it is to be heroic just to exist.
Yeah, I guess I just wanted to say I feel like what's happening here is conservatives have this idea that, I guess I should say transphobes, because there are transphobes on all sides. Transphobes have this idea that if they ban gender affirming care, they ban any talk of trans people and gender identity existing, then we'll just go away and trans people will never exist again. But that is not reality. The reality is we've always existed. And the reason why is because trans people are born trans. We know from neurological studies that that's just the way our brains are wired and we're born that way. That's why I knew when I was 5 years old that I was trans, and I didn't even know there was a word for that. I didn't even know that trans people existed, but I knew that's who I was. So no matter how hard they try to force us back into the closet to try and pretend that we don't exist or that someday we won't exist, we are never going to go away. We will always exist. And that's why we need to keep fighting for our right to exist. Thank you, everyone. Good night.
Thank you, everyone. Have a good night.
Transgender people don't live here.
I've never met anyone who's transgender.
I swear I don't know someone who's transgender.
Transgender and non-binary people like me hear this all the time.
But according to the HRC Foundation, there are more than 2 million transgender people in the United States.
We live in every community across this country.
You might be surprised to hear that there are more transgender and non-binary people in the United States than there are
Starbucks, McDonald's, and Walmart locations combined.
In fact, if you put us all together,
there'd be more non-binary and transgender folks than the populations of DC,
or Nebraska,
or Maine,
or Idaho,
or West Virginia.
As a matter of fact, 15 states have a lower population than the amount of trans folks in the US.
So here are a few things to keep in mind.
You don't always know when a person is trans.
But we're your neighbors,
your coworkers,
your students,
your customers,
and even your friends and family.
We exist in every culture, todas las culturas, throughout human history.
And while we're more visible than ever before,
sometimes you just don't see us.
So when you hear about politicians pushing for discriminatory bills,
know this, these bills address problems that aren't even real.
Problems that don't actually exist.
But we do.
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 And we need your support.
Hi, this is Emma. I am a co-host of Transpositive, and I'm also the current president of the board of directors here at KABU. At KABU, we prove every day that people-powered radio has the ability to bring us together across distances and give us hope when we feel despair. Your friends at KABU want to remind you that generosity has the same power. Join thousands of KABU supporters from all around the world, and let's rally together to build stronger communities. If you can, just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to this number 44321. And thanks so much for your support of KBOO Community Radio. Bedroom surprise.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring a full-time development director. This position leads all fundraising campaigns in alignment with KBOO's mission, goals, and policies. The development director works closely with management and staff to identify funding priorities and create major donor campaigns, capital campaigns, and grant writing. More info can be found at kboo.fm/hiring. We will begin reviewing applications on August 7th, and the position will remain open until filled. KBOO is an equal opportunity employer.